Good morning and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with New York State Senator Gustavo Rivera, who represents a number of neighborhoods in the West Bronx in the State Senate. He was first elected to the State Senate in 2010 and was reelected in 2012. And last week, he won a closely watched primary election for the Democratic Party nomination for another two-year term. And later in today's program, we'll be speaking with Mike Bolin, the campaign manager for Zephyr Teachout's primary election campaign for the Democratic Party nomination for governor of New York State. But before we speak with our guests, our co-host Ron Deutsch was quoted in yesterday's Albany Times Union in an article about a retired 77-year-old IRS agent from Texas who suspects that New York State is not doing a good job of auditing large real estate partnerships. Ron, tell us what this retired IRS agent, Jerry Kernutt, is worried about.
I will, Frank. And how's everybody doing this morning?
Good morning, Ron.
I was surprised to see in yesterday's Times Union an article about an issue that both you and I, Frank, have been working on for some time, and I know AFSCME has been concerned about as well, but it appears that there's these real estate partnerships, basically which are an entity unto themselves. And what happens is the owners, the participants in these real estate partnerships, basically are not paying their taxes on the gains they receive once the partnership gets rid of these properties. So let's say, for instance, the real estate partnership sells the property. Now it's incumbent upon the individuals who are within that real estate partnership to report the gains they received and through the earnings that they got from the sale of that property. Now what's happening apparently is there's a real disconnect at the IRS and state tax and finance level between the real estate partnership itself and then the individuals within that partnership. So the individuals aren't declaring their gains, thereby avoiding lots of taxes. So it's a pretty complex issue. And I know, you know, Jerry Kernutt, who is a retired IRS agent from Texas, he's been working on this for a long time, and not just in New York, but in states like Pennsylvania. And I think one of the interesting points is that Pennsylvania employed Jerry as a consultant to root out some of this fraud. And he was able to easily find $50 million in fraud and then look at another $700 million in potential fraud as well. So this is in Pennsylvania, mind you. So New York is really the epicenter of these real estate partnerships. And now the state will claim that, you know, they're doing these audits, but they're not uncovering any fraud. So,
well, Jerry's point is the state says it's doing hundreds or even thousands of audits. And he says for the kind of audit he's talking about, it's really big and there aren't that many of them. And so if they're doing hundreds or thousands, they're talking about different types of audits than he's talking about, because he's talking about big deals where there were non-recourse loans involved, and the capital gains aren't being distributed among the partners. But anyway, Ron, thanks for the update. We'll keep an eye on this. We're now pleased to be joined on the telephone by New York State Senator Gustavo Rivera. Senator Rivera, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Good morning. Pleasure to be back.
This is Brian McDonnell, and I'd like to welcome our guest, Senator Gustavo Rivera, to The People's Business here on WRPI in Troy. Senator Gustavo Rivera represents a district in the West Bronx that includes University Heights, Belmont, and Tremont, and is considered a rising star in the state Senate. Now, Senator, just last week, a week ago today, you defended your seat in a primary election. You won by a strong and healthy margin. You were also elected to that seat in 2010 by winning another primary against the scandal-plagued Pedro Espada. What is it with you in these contentious primaries?
Well, first of all, thank you for reminding me of his name, because I had forgotten the gentleman that I beat back in 2010.
None of us have.
but in all seriousness, Brian, I mean, there obviously, 4 years ago, I ran because I believed it was necessary that the 318,000 people that I represent here in the Bronx were represented by somebody who actually remember that ultimately we as elected officials and as public servants work for them. Unfortunately, the person who was here before did not really believe that. As far as this one, there's a very long story of local complications. You know, local politics are always interesting. But bottom line, what happened last week is that I was given the opportunity again to represent my district for the next 2 years. In the last 4 years, the main thing for me has been to reestablish the trust of the people that I represent. Consider that not only my predecessor is in prison, but his predecessor also went to prison, and his predecessor also spent a short time in prison. So the last three senators that represented this district have all gone to prison. So it is particularly important for me to reestablish that trust, and I believe that the clear margin of victory last week demonstrates that I've been able to do that.
Got to break that cycle.
Oh, I have no intention. I have no intention of keeping the streak alive, let me tell you.
Good for you.
Good. Well, this is Ron Deutsch. I also want to welcome you, Senator, to the People's Business here at WRPI in Troy. You were first elected to the state Senate in 2010, and then you were reelected from a slightly redrawn district in 2012. And
yes,
as we just heard, you were victorious 1 week ago in the primary election for a new 2-year term. The redistricting plan that first took effect for your 2012 election, it's been the subject of a lot of criticism, and as well as the related constitutional amendment that was adopted for consideration by the voters at this coming November's general election. It's also subject of a good deal of controversy. So
yeah.
I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the redistricting process?
I have been one of its harshest critics. I've always believed on principle that we as elected officials should not pick our voters, but that it should be the opposite. The voters should choose us. And unfortunately, the process in New York State is usually driven by politics as opposed to demographics. I believe that we should have an independent commission. And I believe, unfortunately, that the current proposal for a constitutional amendment does not go far enough. A couple of years ago, when this was voted on in the Senate, I was not in the room. There was I remind your listeners that we, as a Democratic conference, left the Senate chamber in protest because they were considering this particular proposal. I still don't like it. I did not vote for it this last cycle. Now it is. It did pass the Senate two sessions in a row, as is requirement for any constitutional amendment to be considered. Now it's up to the voters, and certainly, ultimately, whatever the voters decide, I will respect. But I personally will be voting against this proposal. I believe that we should have an independent commission and not this particular one. That what it does is it really crystallizes the arrangement in the Senate currently, and regardless of whether the current majority, which is the majority, the Republican-controlled coalition in the majority, whether they are in the majority or the minority, they will have the majority of people appointed to this commission. It's a complicated, calculation, but ultimately I do not believe that it creates an independent process that we need for this to be a process that really responds to demographic shifts in the state and not the political expediency of particular elected officials.
Senator, we're in the process of finishing up the second year of a power-sharing arrangement in the state Senate in which you serve. And our listeners are very familiar with this issue because we talk about it so frequently.
Yep.
It's a power-sharing arrangement between five breakaway Democratic senators called the Independent Democratic Conference and the Senate Republican Conference. At the end of last year's legislative session, or this year's legislative session, there was a lot of media coverage of a deal brokered by Mayor de Blasio from New York City and the governor and several members of your chamber to bring the IDC back to the fold with the Senate Democrats. Can you tell us your perspective on the prospects of that arrangement and where we're going into the future?
Absolutely. Back in 2000, I was elected in 2010 and I was sworn in 2011, and the IDC broke away from the Democratic Conference back in 2011. And they did so saying that it was a dysfunctional conference, that all sorts of things were said about who we were, but that was 4 years ago. I believe that today we are a different conference, and I've said from the beginning, back in 2011, that we would be a united Democratic conference. It would be a more effective governance, and more importantly, that we would actually push for policy that would be more positive for the communities that we represent all across the state. So the arrangement, there's a lot of things that can happen between now and January, but I am certainly working along with my colleagues to get more Democrats elected in November, and then look forward to working along with our IDC colleagues to bring us together and have a Democratic-led coalition as opposed to a Republican-led one. And one more point, particularly for your upstate listeners, the argument is usually made that the reason why we can't put the Democrats back in, that the Democrats can't be in the majority again, is because it would be a conference led by the members in the city of New York. And my response to that would be, let's get more Democrats elected in other parts of the state. I don't live in a suburban area of the state. I don't live in a rural area of the state. There are issues that impact those parts of the state that I don't know that much about. I want Democratic colleagues from those parts of the state to educate me and the rest of my city members on what it is that how could we make sure that the policy that we're implementing in the state Senate as part of a governing coalition next year impacts those areas of the state positively. We understand that we need to govern next year. I believe that we are ready for it, and I am looking forward to it.
Are you surprised that the arrangement between the IDC and the Republicans lasted as long as it did? And I ask you that because we had you on this show more than a year ago, and my recollection mm-hmm. was that you didn't think it was going to last.
I think it lasted for 2 years, and now we have, again, there's many things that can happen between now and January. So there is, as I say, there's many sayings that they refer to when the fat lady sings or what have you. There's a lot of things that can happen between now and January. But I do believe that it is that we find ourselves in a very interesting place because many of our colleagues, a couple of our colleagues that left us a few years ago, recognize that we, as a unified Democratic conference, would make a more effective group of people. So it's what I'm looking forward to is what we're going to do in the future. I recognize that next year will be an incredibly difficult and challenging time for us as we are in the majority. And I understand the reticence by many folks, whether it's in the press or, advocates and voters and listeners of your show. Last time that they took over, it wasn't very pretty. We understand that. The people that really don't want to go back to that time are the folks that are currently in the Democratic Conference. We know that next year we have to govern, and that is what we are prepared to do.
All right. So you have a power-sharing agreement now with Jeff Klein and the members of the IDC, and obviously we will hope that that holds for you as well as it did for the Republicans, I guess. Maybe there's a two-year lifespan on something like that. I don't know. But what's going to be the agenda of this new Senate Democratic conference? What are you going to focus on? And you address some of the criticism that, will upstate be left out in the cold if the Senate is controlled by Democrats? What's a good upstate agenda as well?
Well, I think that the agenda that we're going to follow is bread and butter issues for people all over the state. We need to make sure that we renew rent laws next year, which are very important, certainly in the city of New York, but in other parts of the state as well. They expire next year. We have to look for a real minimum wage boost. I think that the best example of how a Republican-led coalition does not lead to good policy was what we voted on a few years ago as related to the minimum wage boost. The minimum wage hike was over a series of steps. It doesn't go up to 9 till 2 years from now. It doesn't include tipped workers. There's a whole bunch of things in that deal that I do not think were good. But bread and butter issues that are impacting the entire state, and stability is the most important thing, and we all recognize that. We know that there will be a lot of things that a lot of people will be pushing us to do, to respond to. What we are prepared to do is to govern next year, and hopefully we will do so with members of other parts of New York State, not just New York City. This is why CeCe Katchik, Ted O'Brien, and Terry Gibson as members in the suburban parts of the state and in upstate New York are important. Also, Tim Kennedy out in Buffalo. Western New York is obviously an area of the state that needs a lot of help. We want to make sure that that is a member of our conference next year. And hopefully we will have other members of our conference, both in Long Island and maybe in the Hudson Valley. It is those voices that are going to make the policy choices that we make as a conference not only smarter, but better for the entire state.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we are speaking with Senator Gustavo Rivera, who represents parts of the West Bronx in the state Senate. Senator Rivera, what's your outlook for the governor's race?
I think that Governor Cuomo is going to be reelected overwhelmingly. Me and the governor, we've had some disagreements at times, but I do believe that overall he has done a tremendous job. I'm going to continue to disagree with him when we are not in the same page. But bottom line, we are both Democrats, and I do not believe that the policies of Rob Astorino are positive. Certainly not for the district I represent or for the state of New York. So I will be working to make sure that the governor gets reelected, and I believe that he will be.
Assuming the governor is reelected, how do you see the state legislature in this coming year interacting with him?
In a positive way. I will go back to this theme over and over again, not only because I think it's important for your listeners to hear it, but also because I believe it is the truth of our conference. We know that stability next year is the most important thing that we can do. We can certainly talk about campaign finance reform or minimum wage hike, et cetera. And these are policies that we are going to pursue and figure out if we can get done. But the most important part of our job next year is stability, to demonstrate that we can govern, and I know that we can. And so our relationship with the governor is going to be one where we are a co-equal branch of government, and we're going to have conversations with him about what the budget needs to be at the end of the day, what our legislative agenda and our priorities are discussed as a conference, this is another thing. We as a conference, we don't know how many members we're going to have next year. Hopefully we will be joined by a few more. And when that happens, we're going to sit together in a room and we're going to discuss what our agenda needs to be as a Democratic conference and hopefully as a majority conference. So our relationship with the governor, I expect and hope, will be a positive one, a good working relationship, and we'll make sure that we govern next year.
Senator, I'm glad you brought that up. So there are 63 members of the chamber that you sit in the Senate. You need 32 votes to run the chamber.
Yeah.
There are a whole lot of elections between now and next year.
There certainly are.
There are a lot of contentious races, a lot of very close races. You know, on Long Island, for example, there are 9 senators. All 9 of them are Republicans right now. They're called the Long Island 9. Do you see your conference picking up enough seats to get to that magic number of 32, and how?
I do. I believe that. I think that, first of all, there's one seat in the Hudson Valley that was previously held by Greg Ball, who chose to I'm not sure what he chose to do, go to Texas. I'm not sure what he did. It's his birthday today, by the way, so happy birthday, Greg Ball. And there's a gentleman by the name of Justin Wagner who ran against him 2 years ago and is running again. And so I believe that he will be a great addition to our conference. Then we have 3 potential pickups in Long Island, where we have both the open seats for Chuck Fraschillo, as well as Lee Zeldin. Lee Zeldin, who ran for Congress, Fraschillo, who moved on from the Senate, and also a very competitive race in the Martin seat by a gentleman named Adam Haber. And then you have what just opened up in Buffalo, where there was an unexpected loss from Mark Grisanti, from a conservative Republican. Grisanti lost in the primary, which makes that one a potential pickup for us as well. So ultimately, I think that we are in a very good position to be able to have enough. The math works out in a lot of different ways. But regardless of what the math is, we all understand that next year is going to be a very challenging year, and we need to demonstrate, and we will, that we can govern as a conference and that we can run the state. That is what we all know we have to do. As I tell my colleagues all the time, if we do pick up the majority, we get 5 minutes to celebrate. 5 whole minutes. You know, have a drink, do a little dance, you know, get down tonight, but about 5 minutes. And then we have to get to work. We all recognize that, and we are all prepared for it.
Huh. Well, it seems to me there's this kind of schism in the Democratic Party right now where you have kind of your Zephyr teach out progressives versus your kind of centrist Democrats like Governor Cuomo. Certainly the governor has been far more conservative on fiscal policy than he's been on social policy in New York. But I'm wondering, you know, how does that play out with the new Democratic conference in the Senate? You know, I would suggest that you're more in line with the kind of progressive wing of the party in terms of fiscal policy as well. I guess I'm wondering, how do we reconcile these differences within the Democratic Party from, you know, those on the left that are pushing for more kind of progressive economic policy and those that are kind of centrist and are, you know, I mean, the governor's certainly been pushing tax cuts for banks, you know, reductions in the estate tax, things that, you know, we would consider regressive tax policy. Just wondering where you stand on some of this.
I would agree with your contention that I'm the more progressive and left wing part of the Democratic Party, and certainly of my conference, and it is one of the reasons why at times I have disagreed with this governor as much as I respect him. I think that I will go back to the previous theme and say that we understand, and me as one of the more liberal members of the conference, I understand that governing requires for us to come to agreements on policy. That means that I'm not going to be able to get everything I want, and I believe that that any professional legislator understands that that's the way that it works, and I believe that the governor and his staff also understands that that's the way it works. So I'm certainly going to be nudging, and I'm going to be pushing, and I'm going to be prodding internally as I need to do to make sure that I convince my colleagues that more progressive policy agenda is where we need to go, not only in social policy, but certainly in economic one and fiscal policy. And it is up to me and other members of the conference who share my progressive values to make that argument internally in our conference and then make it to other colleagues in the Senate and ultimately to our voters. This is what we do. Being a minority member sometimes is very easy because you can scream from the rooftops and claim that policy X or policy Y is wrong and horrible and shake your fist in the air. We understand that being in government and being part of government is a little different. And I'm going to not lose my values or my principles, and certainly not the interests of my constituency. Those are that's my guiding light, all of those three. But ultimately, I understand that to make smart policy, we have to come to agreements. And that means that it's not going to be as progressive or as liberal as I might like, and some of my more conservative colleagues, it's not going to be exactly how they want. And we understand that's what we're going to have to do when we get to the governing part of it.
So, Senator, the governor wanted to get an overwhelming mandate in the primary election, and he wants to get that in the general election. He didn't get the 70% many predicted. He got about 60%. So next year he comes to the state Senate and he says, I want to cut the estate tax again, or I want to cut the bank tax again, or I want to cut taxes for wealthy people, the things that he's been doing since he became governor. Does the Senate, under Democratic leadership, the way you envision it, do they go along with something like that, or do they stand up against him and fight for a more progressive budget?
Well, I'm going to be in any and all of those issues. We've had the disagreement before, me and the governor and myself, on issues, for example, of the millionaire's tax or the personal income tax surcharge on wealthier New Yorkers a few years ago. It was allowed to expire. I was fighting tooth and nail to make sure that it was that it was extended, because it gives us between $4 and $5 billion worth of revenue that would actually have a positive impact on New Yorkers, not only in my district but across the state. So on a policy agenda on fiscal policy, I'm always going to push for the more progressive side, and I will make the arguments both publicly and privately that type of policy is ultimately a net positive for the state. I understand that there's a balance that has to be reached. And I know that the governor understands that as well. So when we have a Democratic conference, when we have who we're going to have in it, because as I said earlier, we have a couple of new members, hopefully next year. I want to make sure that they are part of the conversation that we have as to what is the stance that we take as a conference. And then our leader, Andre Stewart Cousins, who has already done a fantastic job of bringing us together, even when we might be in different places in certain issues, I'm sure that she will bring us together and present our position, our unified position to the governor. And we have to first have a good who's going to be in the conference, have the conversation within the conference, and then present it to the governor. But from my end, I'm sure we'll be nudging, prodding, and pulling to come more to the left. And I'm not going to lie about that.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with Senator Gustavo Rivera, who represents parts of the West Bronx in the state Senate. Senator Rivera, let's switch gears from the interesting politics we've been talking about to the legislative session, which is coming to an end. First, I have a two-part question. Do you think there's any possibility of a lame duck session this year? And the second question is, looking back on 2013 and 14, if there's not a lame duck session, what do you see as the high points and low points of the past 2 years?
Well, first of all, I've only been in the Senate for 4 years, but I worked in the Senate for a few years before that as a staffer. I do not believe that there's ever been a lame duck or at least a boring session. I've never seen that, and I do not envision next year being that, and this year certainly was not it. There were some high points. On-time budgets are not panacea, but they're certainly good because they demonstrate to the people of the state that we are getting work done. It was not a perfect budget, but I was happy with some aspects of it. There were some things that I was able to achieve in it. I do think that some of the low points. I was not very happy with the defeat of the DREAM Act on the floor of the Senate. I do believe that we need to bring it back, and we need to do the work leading up to it to make sure that we have enough votes to pass it. But overall, when I look back on this year, I think of how obvious it was for a long period of time that we are coming to a point where there's an understanding, a general understanding, that the Democrats are going to be in the majority very soon. There was that sense that I had in the back of my head throughout this entire year, that it was going in that direction. I certainly did not envision that it would come together as it did with the dramatic deal and everything. But ultimately, it was coming in this direction. A lot of us recognized that what we have to do in this period is really prepare to govern next year. That has to be our main guiding post. So it was not a boring session, and I do not envision for it to be boring in the future.
Before we finish up, let me just ask you about one local issue. I noticed in the newspapers recently that you had a success on a local issue you had been working on for a while that dealt with the conversion of a correctional facility.
Yes, I was touring it yesterday.
Just tell us a little about that before we have to finish up.
Well, a few years ago, the governor closed a number of prisons across the state. One of them was the Fulton Correctional Facility in the Bronx, which was a work release facility. The idea that was brought to me by the Osborne Association, which is a nonprofit organization that works with incarcerated people and formerly incarcerated people and prisons as well, was to turn it into a reentry center. And we not only were able to secure the transfer of this facility to the Osborne Association, but also $6 million for its transformation. And we want for that prison in the Bronx to be a model for other prisons across the state. There are possibilities. A few years ago, as I said, sometimes I disagree with the governor, but sometimes I strongly agree with him, when in 2011 he said during his State of the State that prisons should not be engines for economic activity. When he started closing prisons, we have these buildings that are empty. What can we do with them? This is an opportunity for us to rethink about what happens in the communities that have prisons and what can we transform these prisons to. So we're in the process of, as I said, I was touring it yesterday. It's a facility with a lot of promise. Right now we're going through a community envisioning process so that the resources of the building itself can be utilized in a way that impacts the community positively and that they're involved in its development. So I am extremely excited with the possibilities for that facility, and ultimately, when we get it done, for the possibilities that it presents for other closed prisons across the state. What can we do with them in a creative fashion that impacts the community around it positively? So I'm very, very glad that we were able to secure those $6 million this year.
Well, congratulations for your efforts in that regard. This is the People's Business, and we've had the pleasure of speaking with Senator Gustavo Rivera, who represents parts of the West Bronx in the state Senate. Senator Rivera, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
Looking forward to doing it again soon.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks, Senator.
We're going to take a brief break right now, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Mike Boland, who served as the campaign manager for Zephyr Teachout's recent primary election campaign for governor. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is Mark O'Connor, and when I'm in Troy, I listen to WRPI Troy.
Good morning, and welcome back to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness.
Good morning, Mike Boland. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. We were looking forward to talking to you here on 91.5 WRPI in Troy. So, Mike, quite a run you guys had. Just an amazing job you did on the Zephyr Teach Out campaign.
Thank you.
It was a primary fight of all primary fights, and it was quite the David and Goliath kind of story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what it was like running a kind of a shoestring campaign for governor against probably one of the most well-financed incumbents in our state's history?
It was a blast at times, and it was incredibly, incredibly stressful at others. When we decided to go forward, the biggest pushback we got from, you know, various people we respected, you know, people who were supporting us or supporting her previously, was the idea that we would just get trounced so badly that it would be like, you know, an affirmation of a mandate for the governor, and that we would, like, essentially set the movement back. And all throughout there was, you know, at least for me, a real fear that that could happen. You know, we were fighting the good fight. I think I and she both felt like, you know, it was time that somebody needed to stand up to the governor. You know, there had been He had basically, you know, had this culture of fear in Albany where people were just not openly critical of him as aggressively as they should be. I mean, some were, but for a large extent, a lot of people weren't, and we just felt like it needed to be done. In terms of operating on a shoestring budget, it was pretty hardcore. There was a large run of time where we didn't even have an office. We were running the entire petitioning operation out of a public park down, not at Zuccotti Park, but at the atrium at Wall Street, and it was pretty crazy. Like, you know, to administer, you know, 45,000 petition signatures without a centralized office for up until the last about week and a half or 2 weeks of petitioning was pretty crazy, but it had its advantages too. You know, there's a diminishing rate of returns on money in campaigns, I believe. You know, the more money you have, the more money you're going to spend to get the same things. You're going to hire higher priced consultants. You're going to spend on things that get beyond the bare necessities. And I think what we did was we made do with what we had and got ourselves – in the fight. And our operating principle from the beginning was that, you know, in order to get lucky, we need to be in a position to get lucky. We needed to be in the fight, and we got ourselves in the fight. And I think, frankly, we did get lucky. I think the governor made a bunch of mistakes during the campaign that we capitalized on well and positioned ourselves in the end to, you know, at least beat expectations and do better than I think any statewide primary candidate had in any governor's race since 1970, the advent of primaries. So it was a really, really wonderful experience and really exciting and really stressful, especially during petitioning.
This is Brian McDonald, and I would also like to welcome our guest, Mike Boland, to the People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Mike, your candidate won 30 out of 62 counties in the primary. On policy, future policy, what are the short-run and the long-run implications of the Teach Out campaign on New York State?
That's a really great question. In the short term, I think we... put the governor in a position he did not expect to be in, and that was I think all along that his plan was to run to the center, and the sooner he could get there, the better. I think his choice of a running mate showed that he was pursuing, you know, a general election strategy. She was not an ideal candidate for a primary, and by creating a primary, we really, I think, forced him to double down on the more progressive elements of what he has done or what he's saying he will be doing. So I'm hoping that he is less aggressively moving to the center because of it, but time will tell. In the long term, I think we've made a really strong case around around his fiscal conservatism. We've kind of shined a light on it. I think a lot of voters who might not have really realized that maybe realize it now, because we got a hell of a lot of press and, you know, we stayed on message about, hammering him on his fiscally conservative approach and fracking and a few other things that he could really stand to move to the left on.
In the long run, are there implications for the Democratic Party? Are there implications for the minor parties in New York?
Well, I hope so. One of our goals of the campaign was what we've seen across the country is the Tea Party really aggressively challenging the incumbents within the Republican Party. And holding them accountable, if you will, to some of the core conservative principles, that make up the base of the Republican Party. And we really don't see that as much on the Democratic side. You don't see as many high-profile primaries of right-leaning Democrats. And what we're hoping is that our run will have inspired progressives to more aggressively challenge the incumbents of the Democratic Party and hold them accountable to, you know, the progressive values that we all hold. So I'm hoping that is the kind of lasting impact. And again, time will tell on that.
Yeah, the kind of Democratic primary that just occurred between Zephyr Teachout and Andrew Cuomo is different than the kinds of contested primaries we've had in the past when there have been open seats or when there was a Republican incumbent. So, for example, this was even though there was a third candidate, Randy Credico, this really became a two-way contest, and it was rather ideological. Some of the hotly contested primaries in the past were when either there was an open seat, such as when Ed Koch and Mario Cuomo ran against each other for the Democratic nomination in '82, or the Senate nominations to run against Alphonse D'Amato, for example, when Chuck Schumer, Geraldine Ferraro, and Mark Green ran against each other in '98. So we've had Democratic primaries before that have been contested, but frequently they've been 3- and 4-way primaries where there wasn't much ideological difference among the candidates, and it really became more of a popularity contest than defining the party. So I think this is a different type of primary, and assuming Governor Cuomo wins and doesn't try for a third term, it might have implications for the next Democratic nomination.
I hope so, and time will tell. I think that there's something happening in the Democratic Party. I think the rising stars in the Democratic Party are people like Elizabeth Warren, and I think Governor Cuomo got his kind of political education and is molded by the Clinton years, by this kind of strategy of triangulation, this focus on maybe somewhat mythical moderate soccer mom who dominates the electorate and is socially liberal but, fiscally conservative. Maybe there was some truth to that during the Clinton years, but I think the party itself has moved to a more progressive center. And I really think that the governor in some ways is trapped in the kind of strategies he learned in the 90s, and his triangulation is really it's not going to be as effective as it used to be, because the party has moved, and I think going forward people are realizing that. Bill de Blasio has realized that, and I think if there's an open primary for governor, or if there's say Governor Cuomo leaves office one way or the other and doesn't run for a third term, I think that the person who wins the next primary is going to be a competition to see who proves themselves as the most progressive candidate in the race.
So Mike, let me backtrack here a little bit, because I think one of the most interesting stories about this race is how things kind of shook out with the Working Families Party and their nominating convention. Now, you were the state organizing director, right, for the Working Families Party prior to becoming Zephyr Teachout's campaign manager. So the Working Families Party was definitely courting Zephyr Teachout for their nomination. Then kind of at the last minute, Governor Cuomo swooped in and, pulled out all the stops and pushed to get the nomination from the Working Families Party. I'm wondering, in terms of the party's credibility, in terms of the party's standing as a progressive party, do you think they did damage to themselves? And where are you at with the party right now?
Yep, that's a deeply rich question. So let me start by saying that I feel nothing but good feelings towards the Working Families Party. I think the final deal that was struck in the end that secured the governor the nomination was not the right deal for me personally, but was on balance not a bad decision for the party from a policy standpoint. And I'll say that not because of the verbal commitments the governor made, but by moving along the process of getting a few of the major labor unions and the governor himself firmly and publicly committed to winning a Democratic state Senate. And I think the governor's reversal on local wage authorization was a significant change that, if the Democrats were to win the Senate and there was they were able to pass local wage authorization, that would be an amazing change in bargaining power for low-wage workers. And so, WFP had, two major calculuses here. One was it wanted to survive and not become a party completely devoid of the labor movement, because the labor movement was not entirely, but by and large, the labor movement involved within the WFP talking about leaving. And so there was a kind of survival instinct in place there. But there was also two significant policy things. And I think the WFP's kind of major focus for the last, what has been 14 years, has been taking on winning a lasting, functional, real majority for Democrats in the state Senate, and a real focus on low wage workers, you know, people who by and large are not represented by labor unions, but probably ought to be. So, for those reasons, I think the decision was a legitimate one. You know, how progressives will view that, how their brand will survive that, I think is a trickier question, because, you know, this is real insider baseball stuff. And I think most voters just kind of catch the idea that a deal was made. And, like, I think voters have a natural inclination towards being like, you know, I don't like this insider deal stuff, but that's politics. And so, you know, I think the WFP did something that hopefully will turn out good for low-wage workers and good for, you know, progressives who believe a Democratic majority in the Senate is important. And I think the brand issue is a little harder. I think there's a good chance that, you know, their vote totals slip. I think Howie Hawkins is doing well. And again, this will be time will give the answer. But I think for the long game, it was not a sellout. It was an okay decision that wasn't okay for me personally. And when Zephyr was considering running on herself, I just felt an obligation to do it with her, because I felt like the governor needed to be challenged and held accountable in a primary.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we are speaking with Mike Boland, who served as campaign manager for Zephyr Teachout's recent primary election campaign for the Democratic Party's nomination for governor. Mike, you mentioned earlier in the interview the petition campaign you had to run from a park in New York City. How did you do it? Where did you get? Have you organized petitioning campaigns before? How did you develop the ability to pull that off, getting petitions done on time and so many valid ones?
Right. So this was. I actually think this was the most stressful moments of the campaign, because not only is it really high stakes, but it's also not the most fulfilling work. You know, I spent 2 to 3 weeks of my life crossing off the word Brooklyn and replacing it with the word Kings, and you know, on these petition pages, doing little corrections. I had never done a petitioning operation on this type of scale before. I had been around many, many petitioning drives. So I knew what I was doing, but I think what was really helpful was, you know, having run the WFP field operation for, you know, I don't know, 10 years or something, you know, I just had relationships with, like, you know, hundreds of people who had been canvassers, who had been through the WFP's kind of field operations, and I you know, no longer working there, but was able to, like, call upon and put together a team with the help of a couple individuals in particular who kind of set up a firm. A couple former WFP canvassers set up a firm called Patchin Strategies, and it was made up of a lot of WFP alumni. I was able to kind of bring them into the fold. And that provided the backbone for the operation to get the mass of signatures in New York City. And then beyond that, there was just a real outpouring of support across the state, in particularly outside New York City, where what we did was we never really printed petitions. We just put them up online. We put them up on our website, and we blasted out emails saying, download these things, fill them out, and send them in. And in the final week of the campaign, you know, I didn't think we were going to qualify in in 14 congressional districts, which is the requirement. And we just started getting the mail was coming in every day. It was like stacks and stacks of mail, you know, things I had nothing to do with other than putting it up online. And people were just kind of doing amazing work. And it was really inspiring. You know, people we never talked to, like there were entire counties where we never talked to a volunteer there, but somebody had taken upon themselves to organize the petitioning drive, to organize their friends and other Democratic committee people, and they were just sending in thousands of signatures. It was really awesome.
Mike, I want to put this race in context for a second. So in 2006, Eliot Spitzer is running for governor, and he's faced by Tom Suozzi, who was the Nassau County executive. Now, Suozzi had money, he had name recognition, he came from a populous county. He had all these things the teach-out did not have this year. Well, Spitzer faces him, and he gets 82% of the vote. Now, this year against teach-out, I think the governor did everything wrong, right? He skipped debates. He refused to mention his opponent's name. He tries to get her knocked off the ballot, so he looks like a bully. There was that horribly awkward video on the Huffington Post where the governor refuses to even look at teach-out at the Labor Day parade.
The wall of Percoco.
I mean, I think he did everything wrong in this campaign. So can you explain how you guys ran, you know, your strategy when you compare it to, you know, traditional strategies and were so successful?
Yeah, like I'll tell you a funny story in a sec, but I don't want to take anything away from the campaign Tom Suozzi ran or you know what they did. They were in a different position. Governor Spitzer was, you know, not only the clear candidate, the consensus candidate, but he was also had built a fairly progressive reputation taking on Wall Street. And so by primarying him, you know, I don't know if Tom Suozzi would say he was running at him from the right. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, but I think that was the perception. I think that's not a good scenario to be in the Democratic primary. When you're not only going up against the machine, the establishment, you're going up against it from the perception of coming at it from the right. So I think there was an inherent structural thing there that really capped what Tom Suozzi could get. So I think the fundamentals were a little bit better for us. We were running against the establishment. We were running against, you know, the most prolific fundraising machine, you know, maybe ever in our state's history. But we had actual policy differences where we were at the center of the Democratic Party and the governor was not. So I think that was a basic difference that gave us an inherent advantage. I think the mistakes the governor made, you named several of them. I'm going to name one more that I think people, you know, might not realize. After we put in our petitions, the governor's lawyers or whatever, the campaign apparatus made a big fundamental error by not challenging our petitions, but only challenging the residency. Had they challenged our petitions, our entire operation would have been focused completely on a line-by-line protection of each and every signature. And when you're talking about 45,000, you know, that is, like, we would have had to literally look up the voter registration of all 45,000. We were preparing to do that. Had we done that, we would have not, that would have been all we were doing. We wouldn't have started to get our footing with the press. And, you know, it was after petitioning where we really started to aggressively pursue our press strategy. And I think we would have been, you know, 3-4 weeks behind where we were at the end of the campaign had they done that. And not only that, but he challenged the residency. The residency was so solid. We had checked that with four election lawyers when the campaign was still a WFP campaign, because, you know, the WFP couldn't afford to have their gubernatorial candidate knocked off the ballot. So we were sure, as could be, that her residency was solid. So sure that, in fact, I didn't include a committee to fill vacancies on the petition because we wanted that challenge. We wanted them to go after us on court on the residency because we thought it would make them look bad. It would be an early win that would give us momentum. And, you know, by not including a committee to fill vacancies, it was kind of like making them an offer they couldn't refuse. And for whatever reason, they jumped on it. It was a major blunder. We kicked their butt in court twice. And I think at that point, that's when the media started paying attention. Absolutely. They're like, not only did he look bad, not only did we beat the governor in court, but it just kind of gave us a bit of a momentum. And I think what we did there that was really good was we parlayed the court coverage into the debate narrative. That was like the transition. It was like, okay, the governor's gonna ignore us and fight us in court, but if he's gonna fight us in court, he should meet us in a debate. And that narrative really took hold. And I think some of the kind of the limited polling that happened after the election, I think there was a story in maybe the Kingston Daily Freeman showed that a lot of voters really, really didn't like the way the governor refused to engage in a debate. He was willing to spend millions of dollars on mailers and auto calls and paid live phone calls. And he was kind of acting like publicly like there's no election here. I'm not running. But everybody knew that was bull because their mailboxes were flooded. He was in a fight, knew he was in a fight, and I think voters really were turned off by the way he reacted in the campaign.
So, Mike, I could talk to you about this all day long. It's just fascinating. But I guess before we get finished here today, I have a question I have to ask. You know, Tim Wu recently came out and endorsed the Cuomo-Hochul ticket, which surprised me quite a bit. And I know, you know, everybody's wondering where Zephyr Teachout's going to be on this endorsement. I mean, I think she just recently said that there would be no endorsement until October 28th. I think I read that somewhere yesterday. I don't know if that's true, but can you give us a sense of what she's thinking? I mean, is she leaning towards supporting the Democratic ticket or the other, so you know, the other progressive in the race, Howie Hawkins?
Yeah. Look, I think there's really, really reasonable arguments on both sides of this question. And I think, Tim decided to endorse the Democratic ticket, and I think that was a reasonable and legitimate choice. I think Zephyr is certainly much more apprehensive about doing so. I think she, you know, having been through a campaign like this and, you know, there are significant policy differences, and I think she's taking a wait and see approach. I think everybody, you know, myself included, would love to enthusiastically support the governor, but you know, without some real movement on some core policy questions, I think she's finding it hard to bring herself to do that. You know, I think time kind of sometimes time heals wounds, and like, you know, it might be that at the end of the day, you know, everybody is united, and you know, she decides to endorse the governor. But I wouldn't bet on it. I don't think so at this point. She hasn't you know, made a firm decision. I think she's waiting until sometime in October to decide if anything at all. You know, there's really three options. She could, you know, not, she can endorse him, she could not endorse him, or she can endorse him, she can endorse Howie, she could not endorse at all. You know, it's there's no, you know, we're under no obligation to come out one way or another. And I think she's you know, just not trying to jump and make a quick decision about it. And you know, I think if the governor were to really double down and move to a more progressive place, that question would remain an open question and maybe could go that way. But right now, I don't really see it.
So we need to wrap this up. I just got one more question for you, Mike, and I'm wondering what's next for Mike Boland after maybe a week or 2 weeks of sleep. What are you planning on doing next?
Well, look, I've been in campaign mode, like working on campaign hours since April. We were, you know, and really like 4 years. I was in the minority within the WFP 4 years ago. I didn't want to endorse the governor then, but I was on the losing side of that fight. And for 4 years, I was focused on this race. And, you know, and I was working with her, you know, day and night. Not even before that, when we were still recruiting candidates at WFP. So I'm, even though I've slept for a week, I'm still exhausted. I'm going to try to take off the cycle and see where things are at after. I think my stock rose a bit, frankly, in this campaign, and there's probably a lot of options for me. And who knows? Maybe I'm back at WFP. Maybe not. Maybe something else, or maybe even taking a break from politics. Right now, I'm just focused on sleeping late and enjoying the parks and little end of summer, beginning of fall in Ulster County.
Well, then we particularly thank you for getting up early this morning for the people's business. This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've been speaking with Mike Boland, who served as campaign manager for Zephyr Teachout's recent primary election campaign. Mike, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, and I'd love to come back anytime in the future. I really respect all three of you and the work you do, and we'll not be disappearing. So have a great morning, and thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mike.
This is Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute. That's fiscalpolicy.org. Here with Brian McDonald, the Legislative and Political Director of AFSCME New York, and Ron Deutsch, the Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness.